thank you very much. Phil Donahue. it's a real pleasure to be here. I want to preface my talk with 3 points. And one is that I feel a bit like a kid in a candy store here. This is really exciting for someone like me who works in architecture and planning and the instrumental work of shaping space, to be in a space where conversations are being had about the philosophical underpinnings. Because when we do instrumental work, we often neglect to think about what we do and what it does. Although, of course, in universities we have the luxury of doing that. Second thing is, I should qualify myself by saying that I am a lowly designer. I have a PhD in urban and cultural geography, but I have not explored the literature as fully as I would like. That falls under the rubric of political philosophy, although the work that we do in urban design in particular really does overlap in very significant and very important ways. And the third thing is congratulations to the organizers of the conference, excellent work, and it's great to see the lineup of papers, and an apology that I'm one of the bad people that didn't submit his paper. I've been dealing with a very sick parent, and one of the things that falls off the back of the stove at moments like that is some of the writing that we'd like to do. So I'm going to talk about the concept of justice and public space and public life by bringing us down to a case here in Montreal. And it's a space that's been created in the last 5 years in central Montreal. I'll tell you a little bit about where it is. And I want to use this as an illustrative case on some of the questions that we grapple with in planning and urban design. And I want to also mention that this is a paper that I'm working on with one of my graduate students, Pierre-Étienne Gendron, who's here in the room, and it's a work in progress. So we're welcoming comments and questions. What I'm curious about in today's conversation is, can we see Place des Festivals as a bellwether of certain things that are to come? And that is to say, new iterations of the way that cities decide to inscribe power in space. At the same time, is it a relic of some of the work that, or some of the things that we saw happening really in the 90s, beginning in the 80s in places like London with Canary Wharf, and in New York with South Street Seaport, where there was a very strong neoliberal agenda that was literally inscribed in urban space physically. The thing that's interesting is that in Montreal we've decided to build this space in the last few years. So it's a curious indicator, I suspect, of things to come. It may also just be a strange leftover rehashing of old ideas, because we tend to copy things, whether that's in Montreal, Quebec, or Canada. I don't know, we copy things done elsewhere. Before I go on, I guess I should tell you a little bit more about myself. I'm trained as an architect and as a planner. I'm very interested in the normative questions of what we do does, and Frank's question about the reflexivity of urban justice, social justice, is really central to the kind of questions that I set up for my students and the way that I investigate things. And so the material that's in this paper is also drawn from a paper that I've recently published, which actually examines a film called Breaking and Entering. And it's a very fascinating little bit of a snapshot of how designers grapple with power and the positions into which we're thrust by the fact that we are instrumental actors and we actually do things that are not necessarily desirable and that can run counter to our ethics. Okay, 3 main aims for the conversation this morning. First is, I'd like to reanimate discussions that are very familiar, I think, have been well explored on how the professions of space making, the instrumental actors such as architects, planners, and landscape architects, really do inscribe power in urban landscapes. And that's, of course, economists as well, the federal governments of Canada and the US deciding on subsidizing mortgages in the 1930s, 1940s, led to the urban form that we have in the post-war years. And that was a very deliberate effort to make space. To explore the Place des Festivals case study and to open up some questions for our debates, I have the luxury of being the second paper in the day, so to open up some questions that I'm particularly interested in exploring from my perspective, spatiality and justice vis-a-vis the critical practice of urban design. So I guess that when we talk about public space and justice, one of the first things that comes to mind in terms of recent events is the transformation that took place in Egypt, and how this public space in the center of Cairo was so central to the transformation of the political space. I'm sorry if I'm blocking the images here. So this is a very familiar sort of trope in discussions of public space, that we need to have spaces where the will or the issues of the polity can be expressed freely and in some way heard by the powers that be. What I do, I mean, what we do in urban design is not necessarily creating these monumental squares, etc., but think about questions of equity and access in very everyday spaces. And this is one of my favorite examples. You see here, there's an elderly woman with a cane. She started crossing this very typical North American suburban arterial as soon as the light turned green. And you can see she's little over halfway and the light's already turning yellow. This is an example of the stuff that gets people like me up in the morning doing the work that we do, because decisions that are made upstream have profound effects on the well-being of people downstream. We're also interested in things such as good urban spaces that people like to be in and where good things can happen in terms of polity and sharing of ideas and encountering others and dealing with difference and embracing difference is contingent on affordances. And affordances, the concept that was introduced by William Gibson, it's used a lot in industrial design and in psychology of various sorts. But the fact that there's a low planter here affords the possibility of sitting down in public space. When you're out and about in Montreal, if the rain stops, have a close look. There are very few affordances to sit in public space in most cities. And sometimes that's very deliberate. In Venice, for instance, now, it is forbidden for you to sit down in public space in St. Mark's because the restaurateurs are really upset with all of the tourists that come, buy lunch at McDonald's, and sit down on the steps rather than coming to their restaurants, etc. That's an example of the kind of question that we really need to grapple with, as mundane as it may seem. And of course, we are also coming to terms with a lot of the stuff we did. This is one of my favorite examples of beautiful urban design of the 60s in England. This is actually an elaborate system to allow a pedestrian to cross this multi-level roundabout with a throughway, etc., except that these conditions that are created are both difficult for people to use, especially if they're mobility impaired, and create a host of other problems, including susceptibility to crime, etc. Okay, very interested in representations and mediations as well. How does public space exist? How are discussions organized around how should we make our cities good? And these are familiar questions. Because planning and design deals with generative work, we generate policy, we generate physical configurations, we have a responsibility, which we rarely exercise in the professions of architecture and planning, to examine what the impacts are of what we do. Okay, what are the physical and social consequences of certain decisions that are taken? Okay, and so we rely on folks like you to draw attention to some of the implications, etc. Okay. We do have a tradition in architecture of post-occupancy evaluation, which is that when you've built something, you then go into it afterward and examine how well it's used and how effectively it's meeting needs. This is another very important aspect of the work that we do in urban design, not Facebook, but what Facebook represents, okay? And that is to say that there are platforms for engagement that are public domain, but they are not public space in the traditional sense. They are not the streets and squares where people gathered historically in Western cultures to express ideas and discussions, etc. But virtual platforms, which are both a space of engagement with others and also a great tool for engaging different voices in discussions of what kind of physical space we want. So I've just thrown some theoretical hooks onto this slide. I don't want to go through them in detail, but in urban design, a classic piece, sort of an old school piece in some respects, is by Rappaport, Amos Rappaport, in which he defines urban design as the organization of space, time, meaning, and communication, right? The physical configurations of cities actually have profound effects on the way in which people have access to different spaces, opportunities, how time is experienced and what kinds of time investments are needed, and then what sorts of meanings are infused in physical space. John Forrester talked about negotiation, participation, and deliberation as central to our work. Leonie Sondercook, Utopia is a construction site. Utopia is not something that we can create and just walk away from. And then Sharon Zukin has done some really exciting and important work, I think, on the notions of authenticity, how they inform the work of designers, planners, who are the critical infrastructure, often doing the work that enforces nefarious or useful political agendas. The other two points that I wanted to bring to your attention, we're interested, of course, in civil society, a notion called of loose space, that good space is loose. It's not locked down. It's not monofunctional. It does not tell people what should be done and how they should use it. And that's actually Quentin Stevens, who is at, I believe, University College London, and Public Domain, which is a contribution by a couple of Dutch thinkers. Public domain exists in a lot of the spaces that we use as if they were public space, shopping malls, airports, etc. And we have to come to terms with the fact that many people think of them that way. Final point is that there's a great paper that was done by Eisinger, and it's also similar to work that's been done by Susan Feinstein. We find that a lot of stuff has been done in the last 20 or 30 years, which is about building the city for the visitor class. And that's where this case becomes really interesting. We're not building the city for the polity, we're building the city for whatever, middle class tourists, nice people that will come and spend money, stay in fancy hotels, eat in restaurants, and so on and so forth. And these agendas subvert good institutional agendas in terms of pursuit of a common good. Oops. So, again, I'm qualifying myself. These are some examples of projects that I've done. What we try to do in general urban design is we gather people together in this image here, community stakeholders. We have a conversation under ideal circumstances about what is good, what is bad, what would you like to see, how do you want your city or neighborhood to be changed. And then we go away and we sit at computers and we do things and we come up with fancy drawings that mystify as much as I think they they reveal. And hopefully the results are useful and good. But again, we rely on you folks to give us a sense of that. So let's jump to the case study. How much time do I have to talk about? You can say 3 minutes.
Take 5, 6?
Yeah, that's fine. So what I want to just draw your attention to is this local example of what is going on and what we grapple with. We're here down at the hotel. Place des Festivals is over at the Place des Arts complex, and this is an aerial photo showing a neighborhood, it's not a neighborhood so much as it's an official district called the Quartier des Spectacles, the neighborhood of spectacles or shows, and it's a city initiative which was done officially at the behest of artists, cultural actors, etc., as a way to recognize, celebrate, codify, and ensure the vitality and the vibrancy of the cultural sector. So it is officially a state initiative to make something good. Has very strange results, okay? And I'm going to show you why. This is the square itself, Place des Festivals. It's Festival Square, okay? It's basically a paved ground plane. It's on the west flank of the Place des Arts complex. That Stalinesque or Speer-esque building on the left is the Museum of Contemporary Art, which turned its back on this site. Okay, and this is another image. It's called the Place des Festivals because it has been explicitly designed to accommodate shows, outdoor spectacles, and people think of Montreal often as a festival city. We've got a jazz festival, we've got comedy festival, etc., etc. What is fascinating here is that this square has been configured and set up in such a way that its purpose is mainly, if not exclusively, so that shows can be had. And other kinds of public and civic uses are therefore precluded, not just in terms of the physical configuration, but also in terms of the rules that govern, the policies that exist. Now I've done similar work on a case in Toronto, Dundas Square, where you're not allowed to ride your bike, you're not allowed to carry balloons. You can rent the space, you can put on a trade show, but it's not actually public space. It's public space that has been transformed into something else. And the argument that Pierre-Étienne and I are making in this paper is that Place du Festival is just another example of that. I'm not going to talk about its history. I will say that we've done some analyses of how, this is Pierre-Étienne's work here, how the space has actually been set up so that there's very little that goes on in terms of what we would associate with a happy, fun, complex, messy, disorderly urban setting. And I'm drawing on Richard Sennett here, right? I believe very firmly in the uses of disorder as a governing principle for good cities. What we have instead is a very highly regulated, physically hard and tight set of spaces, not loose spaces. And what you see up on the left, where it's happy because people are sort of spontaneously dancing, they're not spontaneously dancing. It's an official dance course that's been organized and is taking place, and it is a city activity. And that's mostly what we see on this space. Okay. What's fascinating in the virtual is that this is an inscription of a civic but anti-civic policy that the city of Montreal has adopted, which is that Montreal is a festival city, and because it's a festival city, this is almost the logic that you can see. Because Montreal is a festival city, we're going to take major spaces in our central area out of the civic realm, out of the use, the range of uses that characterizes the uncertainty of the city, and dedicate them for festivals. Okay? And people are going to get in trouble if they're doing anything that is incongruent with that official, tourism-oriented, happy, jolly, good activity. So what? Three questions that I wanted to raise. What should we do collectively? What should we do, the actors in the professions, professional planners and architects, landscape architects? What should we do to enhance our efforts to make publics? Because so often we find ourselves, and this is the paper that I mentioned earlier on the film Breaking and Entering, instead of actually enabling good things to happen, helping to roll out a carpet of control and domination by market forces and so on. I believe that counter-institutions are very important. Counter-institutions is in third sector, public, or rather not public, but non-profit organizations that allow for voice, especially voices that are usually stifled. Are these usurpations of public spaces for very controlled monofunctional uses, are they actually benign? Am I getting bothered unnecessarily? Because public domain exists in so many other ways that it's not such a bad thing if we let public squares and streets be usurped, controlled in these ways. So I'm playing devil's advocate with myself here. Is it a significant problem? And then the final question, which is specifically raised by Place du Festival, is this just sort of a curious relic of stuff that was done in New York in the 90s with Times Square? It was a way in which the state engaged itself with the market and with the polity. Or is this some kind of new bellwether for new urban landscapes where there are very particular programs and agendas? Because this Quartier des Spectacles agenda was a very proactive and apparently progressive city initiative to empower artistic production. What we're seeing instead is this locking down and a formalized official process of what is good and what is therefore allowable on a space like the Place des Festivals. Don't bring your guitar and start playing your favorite Pete Seeger songs. You'll be booted out pretty quickly. Thank you.
Sorry, I promise not to speak every time, Daniel, but this one is too close to my interest not to. So two nights ago, I spent an aggravating evening at a community meeting where a developer was proposing a monster condo tower in an area that the city would like to develop in a different way. And then there were the neighborhoods. I was representing, I'm the head of a thing called the Planning and Zoning Committee of a neighborhood organization in downtown Toronto. And the developer had two, not one, but two high-paid designers who were arguing his case. And they were arguing, when they saw fit to wax eloquent, they argued it on utopian grounds and charged the neighbors with being NIMBYists, not in my backyardists. That brought back the huge debate that we have in urban theory about, Jane Jacobs' attack on Le Corbusier and Howard and the utopian tradition. It'd be nice to have it both ways. I'm just wondering what you think about that.
The question, I guess, in one sense is the way that justification is constructed and cultured among professionals. So the people who are the high-powered designers have developed a vocabulary and a whole set of actions that allow them to construct plausibility for something like a huge set of towers that may be vastly out of character, may be problematic in many other ways, that represent significant trade-offs, opportunity costs, etc. And I think that is one of the issues that we just have to grapple with. And the problem is that the designers, as much as they're intelligent, thoughtful, and critical thinkers, we find ourselves having to take jobs in which we construct plausibility for very weird decisions, and decisions that we find personally reprehensible in some instances, although usually I think that most professionals would walk away or resign in protest. I think that the bigger question there is how do we deal with change? It's acute nowadays because institutionalized planning has been so successful about saying we want things to stay as they are. We want to have built form that looks like this. We want to keep accessory units out of single-family residential neighborhoods, etc., that there's an exaggerated culture of resistance to change. And we've lost a sense in North America of cities grow and change, and sometimes we need to intensify. Sometimes densification takes place. When you go through some of the neighborhoods right around here, you see always the physical traces of gradual densification. You see it in most pre-industrial or pre-organized cities. I don't know, in the end. The question is a very tricky one, utopianism versus NIMBYism, because I think it sounds like a very polarized example that you're talking about, but we see that increasingly. Yeah, exactly.
I just wondered if you could say a little more about this question that you posed at the end about whether these kinds of usurpations of public space are benign, because you didn't really answer it. And I was wondering if, in your view, it matters if the sort of other modes that are becoming available aren't physical spaces but are more metaphorical spaces like Facebook. So in other words, like, is there something special about physical space such that we're losing something if there's a dearth of physical public spaces that is being replaced maybe by these metaphorical spaces?
As I said, I raised that as a devil's advocate question. Because there is a bit of a narrative of loss when you look at the stories of the North American, the Anglo-American city, that public space is being eroded, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My response to your question is there is a big issue if we lose physical public spaces. And we're not going to lose them in the sense of streets not existing, but what we'll end up with is a greatly impoverished public domain or public space network. That's been said a lot about North American cities, that we have private opulence and public poverty or public lousiness in various ways. So I think that it is hugely important. I do believe that public space matters. I think that we just have to also be wary of romanticizing, the symbolic squares, and to say, oh, well, Montreal, as any city, has to have X square and so on, because this is where people will come to get together. The city is a place for play in many ways in North America now. People come to experience it in a very ludic way rather than in a utilitarian or in a political way. And that speaks to the much larger political question of where is our culture. Now,
why it matters, though? Like, what can't you do on Facebook that you can do in...
I think that what is most important, yes, okay, in my view, is encountering others, is difference. Is that, for instance, public transit is a great moment of being in the polity and being in society, because you encounter situations, people who are vastly different from yourself. And the virtual platforms, etc., are peer-to-peer based. So there is a much lower likelihood that you will encounter very much that's different from what your norms are. And then, of course, we get this erosion of tolerance and of skepticism around the way things are, etc.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Hoi Kong from the law school at McGill. So Nick, I was wondering, is the problem of these spaces a problem of design or of regulation? Right, so you started off with your discussion of affordances, right? So it seems to me that something like the Quartier des Spectacles, the plaza itself, actually has all the kinds of things that you're talking about, all kinds of possibilities for improvisation and for affordances, right? And the problem is that the regulatory regime that overlays it imposes a bunch of exclusions. So is the problem a problem of urban design, or is it a problem of urban regulation?
It's a both end. It's a both end, but it's mostly, as you articulate, is a problem of regulation, the set of rules, because we are remarkably good at adapting situations, hard configurations, into more diverse activities. You just need to look at skateboarders in any hard urban space, literally. And so what's fascinating in the case of Place des Festivals is that it is a very physical expression of this set of regulatory measures. The design of the physical space is excellent, and it is, as I think, loose as it can be. Were the regulatory measures, the controls to be released, to be taken away, it would probably evolve quite readily into an interesting space where there's room for improvisation. But there's an enforcement, there's programming, there's policing, etc., and it's an extension of the same kind of policing and control mechanism to which the designers, Daoulestage, were subjected when they were engaged to physically design the space. The architects who designed the space were told, you can do this. And this is one of the philosophical issues that we really grapple with in architecture and planning, is that we expect that we come in to speak to, well, if we were to want people to encounter others, then one of the things we would want to do is have a diversity of program, et cetera, ensure that there's good public transit access, and so on and so on. Often what we find is that the city says, no, we don't want any of that. We just want to have a space where there's a parking garage entrance, and here are all the rules that are going to exist, and we just want you to design an outdoor theater. So it's mainly a regulatory problem, but then by virtue of the fact that it was inscribed physically in space, those ideas and rules are going to endure. Okay, they become structures of permanence in a sense. Okay, the Montreal example I like to use for this is the Pine Park interchange. It was a major road interchange that was built. The buildings that were built around it subsequently responded to that interchange. City and the public and public discussions decided that we would tear down the expressway interchange and make it into a more human intersection. It's the same sort of thing we saw with the Embarcadero in San Francisco. It's the same kind of debate that has taken place for decades around the Gardiner Expressway in Toronto. It's a structure of permanence. If you take the Gardiner Expressway down, the wall is still there because the buildings that were built responded to that and created a new set of walls. Place des Festivals, the rules were all changed tomorrow, it would remain a very monofunctional, difficult space for quite a while, and then gradually it would be populated.
Thanks, Nick, for an excellent presentation. I want to ask, you're bringing it back to what? Oh, sorry, Daniel Labbé from the School of Community and Regional Planning, UBC, Vancouver. You're bringing it back to the question of how we should, I guess, train designers, or how we should equip them with a moral foundation, ideas of social justice or urban justice, to come back to the previous presentation. And then you talk about counter institutions. And I think the question of institutions is very, very important, because whatever way you're trained as a professional, and I'm talking from my own professional background, you then enter an institutional framework. You work for a client who's paying, in the end, your salary and paying for whatever design you're doing. And it is really, really difficult in that context to put forward your values. I mean, you might be very good at convincing people. I don't know how you train, how we can train architects and urban planner in, should we give them rhetorical, training? I don't know. I don't know if this is one of the ways you're thinking of when you think about counter institutions, or that would be a training. But my question is, where do users come into play? Because they are not users. The people who go into these places are not stuck in that institutional relationship. They have insurgency power. They can use space in ways that were not, planned for. Where do users come into play?
Where the users come in is hopefully that they will justly go in there. And I think that many people go to Place des Festivals and say, well, this is a nice space. I'm going to do what I would like to do there. But the space is a behavior setting where many of the users, whether they're tourists or they're locals, will say, oh, there's the space where I'm supposed to do something very particular behaviorally. And that is irrespective of whether or not they've had some kind of encounter with an authority, the roaming police officer who gives the person a ticket for riding a bike across the square or something like that. Again, it goes to the bigger question of, you talked about, do we train our designers and the planners and the architects? Yes, in passing, I think that there should be courses in rhetoric and political philosophy in every architecture and planning curriculum. And there should also be a mandatory civil service sort of role where you engage with a counter institution as a student. Are we attracting the right individuals? Do the students that come to become architects, planners, do they have the predisposition, so to speak? Are they already aware? And that goes to the bigger question of, to what extent is this symptomatic of broader kinds of apathy societally and so on and so on? And that's where we need to have the bigger conversation culturally, and where public art can play a role, art in general, political debates, etc. And that is why the users, the users will only do what they're familiar with. We have a problem now in North America where people are unfamiliar with living in different kinds of housing typologies because we're now in the third generation of people who are majority terms raised in post-war bungalow sorts of suburbs. And so the city and mixed housing types are mysterious and often associated with very negative sorts of things. So I think for me speaks to how layered the work is. And for me, one of the personal frustrations, of course, one of the reasons I explore this stuff is that I realized as a young architect, one of the projects I put up on the slide there was a building I built in Switzerland where I had to have big arguments with the chief architects about how many toilets I put in the women's washroom. And I said, because the women need to have more toilets than the men have because it's a little bit more involved if you're a lady to do a number one. Well, it's not necessary. It's not necessary, and so on and so on. So we end up not being able to actually act as strongly. As you say, we may be very convincing.
My question was also about design versus governance. And so since you said governance, I would like to follow up and ask if you could elaborate a little bit more. When you were kind of sketching out possible solutions, you talked about counter-institutions. But my impression is that counter-institutions are part of the problem. I'm not that familiar with Place des Spectacles, but I know Yonge Dundas Square in Toronto a bit. And of course, that was an initiative of the Business Improvement District, which is not governed on the same democratic principles of the municipality. And it has a special governance board, which gives some seats to people from the city council, but also a number of seats to members of the Business Improvement District and other large property owners in the area. So I guess, what kinds of criteria do we have for institutions? And was this, in fact, an initiative of the city in Montreal? Because often, I think there's the creation of these special public-private special districts that allows them precisely to circumvent the democratic institutions that could deal with this if they were allowed to. And then I have a second question. And it seems to me in the story you told, and I know there was sort of limited time, but you kind of pitted this diverse, multi-use civic space against a more instrumental, commodified commercial space. But it seems to me, at least in the case of Yonge Dundas Square, there's really a third part of this story, and that's disciplinary space. I think this initiative to create Yonge Dundas Square was motivated largely because you had a very intense shopping core corridor, and then a very, dangerous or perceived as dangerous low-income part of town. And so it was a way of kind of taking back more of that space and to implement new ideas about policing and about social control. And so I was wondering if that was also part of the story, which you didn't have a chance to tell here in Montreal. And that led me to sort of, at first I thought, why is he comparing this to South Street Seaport? It sounds like it couldn't be more different, so the sort of historic, nostalgic architecture, the kind of thing Sharon Zukin talks about. But then it occurred to me that maybe what's at stake here really is the use of culture as a way to mystify the increase of disciplinary space and a new kind of policing. So I was wondering if that, in fact, was the link.
I think that is a very good way of expressing one of the central issues, that culture is being used to mystify or to justify, to as part of the plausibility of why this kind of state action can be taken. And that's where there is a pattern of similarity. I think those are excellent questions. The disciplinary dimension, shall we say, of Young Dundas, there's no question that was a central motivating force. And it was not only part of what led to the formulation of an initial strategy in terms of the business improvement area, but then the decision to scale up and to do some kind of radical surgery. And the case, I did detailed work on it with one of my mentors, Beth Milroy, who wrote an excellent book on it. It went to the Ontario Municipal Board, and one of the arguments was that the area suffers from social blight. And that, to some extent, is what has happened in the Quartier des Spectacles. There was a perception, certainly St. Catherine Street is in the last 20 years was down at the heels. It was perceived by certain social groups as dirty, dangerous, undesirable, et cetera, et cetera. So the Quartier des Spectacles was, as much as it was officially about empowering artists and enabling creative, shall we say, enterprise or resistance, it was about the state, we're going to clamp down on this badness, and we're going to clean it up, and we're going to make it nice. The first question, then, the counter-institution question, I agree. What kind of counter-institution? And for me, the counter-institutions that matter are the third sector groups that are working to enforce the principles to which Patrick referred, for instance, democratic engagement. And we have several of those in Quebec. There's no question that if we just say counter-institutions are essential, I think the counter-institutions are what help to deal with governance matters when government, as has been the case for quite a while now in North America, pursues a very aggressive, market-oriented agenda instead of defending the rights of people to the city and advocating for making publics and actually making the effort to make publics. I don't know if that answers the question, but it's a really good one that I'd like to think about some more. Yeah.
Aaron Ben Joseph has this fascinating history of the building code, right, where we think of as this benign technical thing, but of course it's not. There's the same sorts of disciplinary processes. Does that come into play in your experiences in public design, or is that sort of a different beast? I mean, do you ever see that deployed in this regulatory fashion to sort of discipline public space?
It is much more powerful in the case of public work, but it's much harder to actually identify what the causes are. With the building code, in the case of the building code, we know that there are certain measures that precluded this, precluded that. It's rare that we can actually find. This is why there's such an important question around what are the effects of what we do. When there's generative work done, and it's more on the policy side, when a public policy is created that offers us a tax break to X, what are the actual physical effects? And when we see a situation on the ground which is problematic or which makes us scratch our heads, it's very difficult to actually track back and say it's because of this policy or that measure, et cetera. And yet it is imperative that we do so. And there's a lot of work that's been done in housing and domestic space around this. Marion Roberts did excellent work in the 80s, 90s, living in a man-made world. And then a lot of excellent work in terms of queer space, queer theory, et cetera. So I think it's more serious, but it's a lot trickier because we don't have an easy upstream force.
that needs to be dealt with.
Thanks. Laurie Bacro, Université de Montréal. I don't know if you speak French. Okay. Donc je peux poser ma... Okay. J'étais très intéressée en fait dans votre exposé sur la façon dont vous avez présenté l'espace public, dont le pouvoir en fait peut être incarné justement matériellement dans des voilà spatialement dans la ville. Il y a plusieurs choses qui m'ont intéressée, la notion d'espace public en fait d'Anna Arendt, de créer des espaces démocratiques qui sortent des espaces plus proprement économiques qui peuvent exister comme downtown ici ou d'autres espaces dans d'autres villes. Vous avez aussi montré en fait, une photo de ce qui s'est passé au Caire et des révolutions, et comment est-ce que, voilà, il y a des espaces qui pouvaient être aménagés, en fait, pour le jeu démocratique dans les sociétés. Mais la question que je me posais et qui m'intéressait vraiment, c'est, bon, à travers l'histoire, les places, en fait, ont une importance très importante dans les révolutions et le rassemblement populaire, bon, pour des demandes d'égalité ou d'autres. Et ce qui m'intéresse, c'est que ces places-là, donc là, bon, l'exemple du Caire ou d'autres pays, ne sont pas nécessairement créés pour être des rassemblements démocratiques et encore moins des rassemblements de contestation du pouvoir. Et ce qui est particulièrement intéressant, c'est de voir comment des espaces publics qui n'ont pas été créés pour ça sont détournés par le peuple et réinvestis, en fait, avec une force politique, alors qu'à la base, elles n'étaient pas du tout conçues pour ça. Et la question que je me posais par rapport... Bon, ça, c'est un premier point que vous avez aussi abordé, mais j'aimerais bien plus vous entendre là-dessus, sur ce détournement, en fait, de l'espace public. Et d'autre part, par rapport à votre fonction, alors je ne sais pas trop comment ça fonctionne, et vous avez apparemment une vision très intéressante là-dessus, mais qui vous paye et pour faire quoi? Et à partir de là, est-ce qu'on peut vraiment attendre d'un État qu'il paye des gens pour construire des espaces de contestation à l'intérieur de... Enfin, de voilà.
Sure. The two questions were very, very quickly. Can resolutely non-public spaces, places that aren't designed to serve a sort of Arendtian public function, be sort of kidnapped by the public in order to serve public functions? And, you know, the example of Cairo is brought up. And the second is, can we expect the state that pays planners to pay them to do, to plan spaces that might end up being subversive from the point of view of the state, more or less?
Je peux rendre en anglais parce que those are excellent questions, and I think that in response to the first one, yes, it can happen. It is what happens normally in the sense of what happens when people appropriate space. And in fact, even if there are governance rules, this is the case with Cairo, that say you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't gather, etc., it can happen and it does happen, and we want to see that happen. And it reminds us of the fact that the public, this is why I referred to the narrative of loss, the public is not something that was there and we can take for granted. It's something that we are always constructing. We are always making public space. And that's something that we all do. This is what Michel de Certeau talks about in Walking in the City, for instance. Very powerful ideas around how we each individually have a responsibility. And so in respect of the second question, indeed, will the state pay for planners to create these things? I think there's a bit of subversion that we can always build into the spaces, that, you know, we can create the possibilities for certain things to be done and not to be done. In the end, I think that what's important is a relaxing of the governance rules. That's, again, why I refer to Richard Sennett, because I think that we need to be relaxed and let things happen and allow spaces to be loose. I don't know if that goes to the question, because it, you know, what is the role of the institution then, and how can we as the users, how can the polity keep hammering away at the state to ensure that we're making the public rather than assuming that the state will defend the notion of the public.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Nick. That was fascinating.
Thank you.